Tillerson rejected the National Commission's finding that the BP blowout placed in doubt the safety culture of the entire industry. He argued that the Commission did not investigate the entire industry, and so their finding seems to ignore years of record of good performance. And yet the Commission reached its conclusion in part because the record shows that in the absence of effective federal regulation, the offshore oil and gas industry will not adequately reduce the risk of accidents nor prepare effectively to respond in emergencies. Tillerson could hardly reject the criticism about preparedness. Under his leadership, ExxonMobil had not invested in accident response capabilities in proportion to the new risks created by deepwater drilling. The corporation was not especially active in the Gulf, but it was moving to increase its presence, and it pledged preparedness in regulatory filings. The costs of preparing aggressively for a rare blowout such as the Deepwater Horizons, acquiring and positioning adequate equipment, rehearsing and planning to the same level of precision that the corporation brought to drilling operations, might be high, but they were far from prohibitive. The record showed that ExxonMobil had not made these investments, nor urged that others in the industry do so. "Your accident response plan is written by the same contractor that BP's is," Bart Stupak, a Michigan congressman, reminded Tillerson at a hearing that summer, as oil continued to pour into the Gulf. "So if you can't handle 40,000 barrels of spilled oil a day, how will you manage 166,000 per day, as ExxonMobil's plan claimed could be managed?" "The answer is that when these things happen, we are not well equipped to deal with them," Tillerson admitted. "So when these things happen, the worst-case scenarios, we can't handle them, correct?" "We are not well equipped to handle them. There will be impacts, as we are seeing. And we've never represented anything different than that. It's just a fact of the enormity of what we're dealing with." "But they do happen." "It just happened." A containment dome fitted onto the Gulf's floor above the spewing Macondo wellhead capped the blowout on July 15, 2010, just under 3 months after it began. The crisis faded rapidly. Americans had other problems on their minds. Voters angry about public debt, busted mortgages, Wall Street greed, and high unemployment went to the polls less than 4 months later and replaced the Democratic majority in the House of Representatives with Tea Party-influenced conservative Republicans devoted to smaller, less intrusive government. The Deepwater Horizon blowout reinforced popular anger toward big oil, but would produce no new politics to threaten the status quo in American energy policy. The accident's economic victims, commercial fishermen in Louisiana, coastal hotel owners, offshore oil workers, lived mainly in the states whose citizens voted repeatedly to accept the ecological risks of deepwater drilling. 85% of the world's energy, to fuel cars and trucks, to run air conditioners, to keep iPhone-tapping legions fully charged, still came from taking fossil fuels out of the ground and burning them. The likelihood that this would change any time soon appeared slight. ExxonMobil faced serious trials as a business in the years ahead: annual reserve replacement, maintaining its share price by extracting full value from XTO's unconventional gas holdings, and global competition. But its place at the heart of America's energy economy as a bastion of fossil fuel optimism remained unchallenged. Forecasting peak oil, the moment when world supply will reach its height and begin to decline, is a fool's errand, the long record of inaccurate past forecasts would suggest. At a minimum, there appears to be enough oil left in the world to meet projected rates of demand for several decades and likely longer. Gas and coal supplies are even more abundant. Mongolia alone reports probable coal reserves of 152 billion tons, enough to fire every smoke-spewing power plant in China for half a century. Russian, Qatari, and Iranian natural gas deposits should last many decades, and the United States may be able to meet its own gas demand from domestic supply if unconventional reserves fulfill their promise. Fossil fuels that emit carbon dioxide when burned are therefore likely to remain embedded in the world economy for at least half a century longer, barring a radical scientific breakthrough that allows a renewable energy source to compete economically at gargantuan scale. It seems just as likely that the costs imposed on American society by fossil fuel dependency will remain high for an indefinite time. Between 2004 and 2009, the United States ran a deeper trade deficit, between $186 billion and $414 billion each year, to import oil and gas than it did to import goods from China. The regimes in receipt of these outbound dollars, Saudi Arabia, Russia, Iran, and Venezuela, to name four, were chronically unfriendly. Rising global oil prices, usually caused by wars, strikes, or politics overseas, have preceded 10 of the last 11 American economic recessions, including the Great Recession that began in 2008. That downturn was caused by a financial and housing bubble that would have burst disastrously even if every American drove a magical self-powering windmobile. But the spike in fuel prices on the eve of the bubble's reckoning weakened confidence in household balance sheets at a turning point. Rising oil demand from two-car families and the world's swelling new middle classes in rising economies such as China and India, combined with the chronic instability of oil exporters from the Middle East to West Africa to Venezuela, means that oil supply and price shocks are likely to recur more frequently, adding to the multiple sources of American economic insecurity. All of these economic costs of oil dependency have been evident since the 1970s, yet American democracy has produced no politics to reduce them. The lobbying power of oil corporations is hardly the only factor. Oil prices gyrated during the 1980s and 1990s. At the bottom of these cycles, gasoline was often a trivial segment of many household budgets. During the late 1990s, gasoline expenses averaged as little as 2% of American pre-tax household income. That made it relatively painless for American voters to ignore oil dependency's indirect costs and to reject the higher gasoline taxes that would be required to incent change. By the summer of 2011, gasoline expenses approached 10% of household income, at a time of widespread economic pain. The opposite kind of policy paralysis now took hold. To change the gasoline pricing system that embedded oil dependency would impose heavy new costs on working and middle-class families suffering the most in the aftermath of the Wall Street-fueled housing bust.